This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword. Sword and Laser, episode number 32. I'm Veronica Belmont.
And I'm Tom Merritt.
And this is a special interview podcast today. We will be talking to Laurie R. King, who is one of my personal favorite authors and someone who I think you guys will enjoy. It's a little bit of a departure from our usual sci-fi fantasy stuff. She primarily focuses on mystery, detective mysteries. But she has actually worked on a futuristic post-apocalyptic novel, but we'll talk about that a little more later.
And her mysteries are fantasy-ish,
I would say. Yeah.
I can't wait to get to know her more. I'm excited about this, too.
Yeah, I've been steadily reading her books over the past year and a half or so. And I'm just really honored to get to have her on the show today. So we'll get to that in a little bit. But first, we have some quick burns for today.
Yeah, just one, actually, because we just did an episode last week. There's not a ton of sci-fi book news, a lot of movie and TV news, but there was a really interesting post that I saw on geeksaresexy.net, which I had never heard of before, but I don't know how I stumbled across this. They have 5 epic science fiction series to read this summer. Some of which we have read before, or at least started before, on Sword and Laser. So I thought we'd go through their picks here and see what we thought of them, and then ask you guys on Goodreads to kind of throw in, like, what do you think of these 5, and what 5 would you put in? Series, epic science fiction series.
Sci-fi series. I don't read a lot of sci-fi series. I read a lot of fantasy series. So
We can open it up.
Yeah.
I mean, we should not leave out the sword side.
I get very defensive when the sword gets left out.
Absolutely. And then I get run through.
Yes. Yes. So the first one on the list is Saga of the Scolian Empire by Catherine Asaro, which I haven't read.
I have not read these either. They combine hard science fiction with romance. A lot of times, apparently, they get the reputation of being for girls. But if you are a fan of hard sci-fi, especially in the form of physics and biotech, don't doubt Catherine Asaro's cred, says the author here, just because she sneaks in the romantic entanglement. So this actually sounds perfect, which is not leaving out that softer touch in a hard sci-fi novel that's got like some really good physics in it. This looks pretty good. I might pick this up.
Excellent. The second one is the Night's Dawn trilogy by Peter F. Hamilton, who's a very well-known sci-fi writer. And apparently these are more in the space opera vein.
Yes.
Which is definitely really getting into the whole saga of the sci-fi side of things.
But it is only a trilogy, so it's not going to, you know, set you back all summer long. You'll still have room for other things. World here is pretty sprawling. It's hard to describe these books briefly, but the gist of it, according to this author, is that it's a far future with tension between users of biotech and nanotech, and then the souls of the dead start coming back.
Of course.
You know,
obviously.
Through living possession. These things happen.
And then, of course, a author we are very well acquainted with and a series as well, the Ender's Game series. We read the first book in that series, Ender's Game, of course, but there's like 9 or 10 or 11 of these books.
I have read
this
entire series going forward. They actually started, Orson Scott Card started writing prequels, and I never got into the prequels. But I read all the way through the first, I think it's the 8 that go right down the line of the entire history over a 3,000 year span. And they are not all as good as Ender's Game.
No,
they're not. If
you just want
the best, read Ender's Game and be done with it. But if you're really interested in this world after you've read Ender's Game and you want to find out how things work and get some really interesting takes on society and how society might happen, they revive at one point an old Celtic practice, which is the marriage contract. Whereas so people get married for short periods of time, and then you could just cast them off And so there's playing with all kinds of sociological things. And of course, there's long lived people who live over these thousands of years. So I like it, and I wouldn't recommend it for everyone. But I would say if you really were enraptured by Ender's Game, you wouldn't be wasting your time to make
it. I would say at least read Ender's Shadow, because it goes more into the story of Bean, who was one of my favorite characters.
Yeah.
So if you're going to continue reading, you know, go through Ender's Shadow, Speaker of the Dead, and they get pretty hardcore.
The next one is the Dune novels, which we have talked extensively about on previous episodes of Sword and Laser. I have read through this series 3 times, just the original 6 anyway. Mm-hmm. I've also read lots of the extended universe that Kevin J. Anderson and Brian Herbert have read. And I would say those original 6, so worth it if you haven't traipsed through that. But let's move on to the last one, The Time Quartet by Madeline L'Engle. Have you ever read these, Veronica?
I've read A Wrinkle in Time, but I don't think I've read... I haven't read The Time Quartet.
A Wind in the Door, A Swiftly Tilting Planet, and Many Waters continue the story. And I haven't read them in years. It was the 80s when I tore through all of these. But I really remember loving each one of them as much as A Wrinkle in Time. Like, they really continued the story very well, kind of the way C.S. Lewis did for me with Narnia, mm-hmm. where The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, that spirit was kept in all of the subsequent books for me. Even the weird ones with the silver chair and all of that, I still felt like that you still got that same nugget of feeling and spirit out of the writing that you had in the first. A lot of times the series, you can't say that. I wouldn't say that of Orson Scott Card's Ender's series, but I would say it of this one.
Yeah, I've also read the Alvin Maker series by Orson Scott Card, and that one gets a little bit tedious too. It's kind of one of the situations where the first 2 or 3 books are really good, and then it just gets a little weird. But these are great suggestions to add to your Goodreads list if you want to start making a nice to-read list for the summer, a summer reading list, if you will.
Yeah, exactly.
A good place to start.
I'm going to give it some thought and go on to Goodreads and put down, like, if I had to pick 5 series, what I would pick.
That's a good idea. We'll start that thread after the show.
Before we get there, though, we do have our sponsor.
Of course, our sponsor. I'm so sorry.
Our sponsor is Audible.com, as you know. They are purveyors of fine audiobooks. In fact, they got 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. If you think it's just all weird stuff, it's not. It's good stuff. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. So you go to audiblepodcast.com/sword, S-W-O-R-D, and you can pick a free audiobook to try it out. What do you think we should pick?
I'm going to have to go with The Beekeeper's Apprentice, which is the first in the Mary Russell series by Laurie R. King and narrated by Jenny Sterlin.
Yes, that's of course, it'd have to be a Laurie R. King, because you're going to find out all about her now when we interview her. So why don't you try out The Beekeeper's Apprentice on Veronica's recommendation, audiblepodcast.com/sword.
We want to welcome to the show Laurie R. King, author of one of my favorite book series, the Mary Russell series of historical mysteries featuring Sherlock Holmes as her partner, and also a series featuring police officer Kate Martinelli, as well as several standalone novels. King's first book, A Grave Talent, in 1993, received the 1994 Edgar Award for Best First Novel and a 1995 John Creasy Memorial Award. Using the pseudonym Lee Richards, she has published a futuristic novel, Khalifa's Daughters, in 2004. Did I say that right?
Khalifia, as in California.
Oh, excellent. You feature California a lot in your books.
Yeah, well, what can I say?
It keeps coming back.
Yeah.
So first off, how did you come to find yourself taking on the Sherlock Holmes canon? Have you always been a Holmes fan?
Oh, no. No, I think there must have been one of those Granada television series playing on CBS and on PBS during the time that I was playing with the idea of writing a book, because I decided that what I wanted to do was look at, in effect, a young female 20th century version of the great detective. What would she look like? What would she talk like? And really, because it's more interesting to put 2 similar things next to each other by contrast, he came along for the ride.
So Mary Russell came first.
He hijacked his way into your book.
Yes. One of the marketing people at Random House came up with the priceless heading, "Meet the World's Greatest Detective and Her Husband, Sherlock Holmes." Which I thought put it in a nutshell.
Excellent.
You must have had to do extensive research into the whole Sherlock Holmes storyline and all the characters. How long did that take?
Well, I no sooner started writing the books, and I started with a line that's still in there. I was 15 when I first met Sherlock Holmes. I no sooner started writing than I thought, oh dear, I really do need to know something about Sherlock Holmes, don't I? So I trotted down to the bookstore and bought a collected Conan Doyle. Two volumes, very, very small print of the 56 and four novels. So I really met Holmes as an adult. And coming to the what's called the canon as an adult, I think changes the way you see Holmes. Because, I mean, you tend to think of Holmes as being a sort of adventure hero and a thinking machine and terribly clever. But when you actually read the stories for the first time, your impression is that of a man who is consumed by his passion for setting things right. I mean, this isn't just a man who takes on a case because it's kind of interesting, although he would have believed that. It is a man who is completely consumed by the need to apply modern techniques to major problems.
Mm-hmm.
How to address the world's evil and the world's lack of structure by rational means. And that really is the Holmes that you meet as an adult. That's something you see in there. Also a man with a sense of humor, which I hadn't really expected. I think that, again, that PBS podcast of Jeremy Brett caught some of the humor, which is very much there and quite unexpected.
Now, was your impression of Holmes pretty much just picked up at random here and there by seeing things like the PBS special and hearing allusions in other works?
I think that Holmes is so much a part of our culture, it's hard not to form a picture of him. They say that you can take a silhouette of the man with the pipe and show it to pretty much anyone on Earth, including in Highland, Papua New Guinea, where I have been, and people will recognize that this is Sherlock Holmes. He is probably the most recognized individual, certainly fictional individual, that you can find. And so, yes, I would say probably I had images of him that were a combination of any reading I might have done. I mean, I'm sure that everyone has to read maybe The Speckled Band and Hound of the Baskervilles, you know, in high school.
Yeah, well, Hound of the Baskervilles is always a popular choice because it's short for your book report.
Yeah, it's a nice, quick novel, isn't it?
So, how has the reaction been from really diehard Holmesians who've read your take on his later years?
When I first started, and as you said, this is 1994 that The Beekeeper's Apprentice was first published, and I've published 10 in the years since then. When I first started, I think that a lot of devout Sherlockians were very dubious about the whole thing. Because there's an awful lot of pastiches out there. And some of them, indeed, are the kinds of pastiches that are more romance than anything else. I think that there was some concern early on that this King woman was doing yet another one of these sort of thinly disguised Sherlockian erotica. But when they came to see that I had a tremendous amount of respect, not only for the character of Holmes, but for the writer Conan Doyle, and that I didn't let all this clutter of emotion get in the way of the stories, I think that my steamy scenes, are things like Holmes brushing Mary Russell's hair. That's about as hot as
it's Victorian. It's Victorian hot, not modern day hot.
Yes, the books are written as if by a woman in her late 80s writing her memoirs. Mm-hmm. And she is a woman like Holmes who is very self-contained, not too certain about how much respect she should have for the rest of the world. And therefore, her basic attitude is, honestly, it's none of your business. And so the stories are written from that point of view, that there are occasional references to actions that are permitted in the marriage bonds, but you don't really need to know the details.
Yeah, and Mary is definitely, she's very much the feminist, especially for her time, but yet she still has that very self-contained attitude that you mentioned.
She is very much that kind of British woman, isn't she? I mean, people tend to think that that British women of the early 20th or late 19th century tend very proper and repressed and all the rest. But when you read something like Gertrude Bell, I mean, this woman goes off in the desert and she hires Bedouins to walk around the countryside. And she gets to know the desert so well that she basically is put in charge of digging up the least after the war. And so if you are wanting to point a finger at who is responsible for Iraq, Iran, and the rest, it's that one lady, Gertrude Bell. Mm-hmm. Well, that kind of female is found all around British history. And I think that Mary Russell is very much of that type.
So you've written many other books. Would you say it's easier or harder to create a story based off an existing, well, for the most part, cast of characters or just starting from scratch?
I would say that a standalone novel is a lot of work because you are creating that entire universe. And with a series novel, whether it's a Russell series or one of the Martinellis, I kind of know where I'm starting out. Mm. Not only with the people, I don't mean just that I know the city and the cast of characters, but I also have the kind of voice and the sort of story that I need to tell fairly clearly in mind. I mean, the Russell voice is something that determines what story I tell. Whereas with the standalone, I don't know what the voice is until I get way into the book.
Right. Speaking of voice, this is kind of off topic a little bit, I listened to the first 9 books in audiobook form. And Jenny Sterling, of course, reads the part of Mary and everyone else for that matter. Do you think of her as being Mary's voice now? Did you work with her very much, or was it more of a here's the book, start reading kind of situation?
Well, I have little to do with assigning books. This mm-hmm. is that Recorded Books does. And to tell you the truth, I don't listen to my books. Neither do I read them after. Mm. My favorite time in the life of a book is when I have finished with the proof pages and I never have to read it again. Because all I see are the mistakes. The further on a book gets, the more I see the flaws and the repetitions and the, oh, I should have done that and that.
So we've heard this from a lot of authors. A book is never done being written. You just have to kind of finally let go of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do know writers. I have friends who are writers who sit down when they get their hardback, they sit down and they read it. And I frankly do not know how they can bear it because all I see are things that are left undone. Mm. So, but I have listened to a complete one of Jenny's books. I had to listen to O Jerusalem.
I had to listen.
Well, I was writing the next book, Justice Hall, and I needed to get the attitudes and the voice and the personality of the two Bedouins because I'd actually written the book a number of years before. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to read it, but you know how it is with something you've written yourself, you just skip over it. And because you know all the words, you get all the jokes, remember all the stuff. And so I found that I couldn't get enough detail by just reading the pages. I had to listen to them because it forces every word to come past at the same speed. And I enjoyed her reading a lot. I like her stuff a lot, and I know that she's got a tremendous fan club among the Russell listeners or readers.
Yeah.
And I think that quite a few of them would indeed answer that question. Yes, we do think of Russell as being Jenny Sterling.
It was very strange to read the final book in book form for the first time. And I definitely used her voice in my head as I read through.
The voices in my head are different.
So I'm curious, when writing a mystery, how do you map out the whole thing? Do you decide the ending first and work backwards? Or do you kind of discover things as you go along, like an episode of Lost?
Oh, dear. Lost is a good description of what I am. Uh-huh. I am not one of those writers who can outline. I was always one of those kids in school who wrote the paper and then handed in the outline because it made no sense to me that you could even envision an article or a book without writing it.
I always did that, too. I'm glad you admitted that.
Well, it's just I think that it's just the way people work. There are times when I can not really outline, but sketch ahead a bit. And there are times when I know the basic structure of a book before I start. But beyond that, you know, I just can't do it without doing it. I'm one of those writers who, you know, what is the saying that you can drive across the country by just what you see in your headlines? And that's how I write a book, is just what I see on the page coming up. Somewhere in the back of my brain is a mechanism that does keep track of things. I mean, it is quite interesting that I will, for example, if I come to a point where I just can't stand the idea of writing anymore. I mean, it's what's called this block and really means that you'd rather clean the oven with a toothbrush than do one more day of work. I find that almost always when I feel that way about a book, because the back of my mind is trying to get me to pay attention, the fact that I'm writing myself into a corner. In the back of the head, there's this organizing principle that's relatively efficient, that keeps track of the plots and subplots, and that reminds me what I need. And it's really quite an amazing thing. I have no idea how it works.
That's incredible.
Do you ever get surprised when you find out what the mystery was while you're writing it?
Yeah, I often am surprised. What I tend to do is I'll write a first draft, and it takes me roughly 3 months, 300 pages. And that first draft is my outline, more or less. That is, it tells me what the book is that I want to write. But it isn't until I get to the rewrite process that the book actually comes into existence. The first draft of my books, almost all of them have been absolutely unreadable. I mean, they're just a mess. Make no sense. But looking at them, I get a sense of what the story is about, what the theme is, what I'm trying to do with the story, what the flavor is. And at that point, I can start the rewrite process of shaping this blob of shapeless clay into the shape that it really needs to be, and that's, you know, that's my transformation of from an outline into an actual book is the second draft.
Now, we got a question submitted by one of our listeners named Vance. He wanted to ask you, do you find it hard to keep your homes consistent with Conan Doyle's? Do you ever think, WWCDD.
And I tried to start books or to get myself jump started as I was going with reading sections of Conan Doyle, thinking perhaps it would be contagious. And I found that it lasted about two lines, and then, you know, my own way of writing would come back. Hmm. Clearly, I'm not susceptible to contagion. I will quite often reread sections or pick up stories and remind myself of attitudes. The problem is that with 10 books, which I've done in the Russell series, I have gone quite a ways beyond where Conan Doyle left Holmes in 1914. Mm-hmm. And Conan Doyle's Holmes stops at the beginning of the Great War. Mm-hmm. And mine goes on and reinvents himself in the light of what that war did to Britain.
I loved how you explained that whole disappearance, that whole time off that he kind of took. It was a very interesting way of bridging the two worlds.
That's the period that Conan Doyle describes after the Reichenbach fall and before he reappears in London. He brings Holmes back to life. And all that Conan Doyle has to say about that period is that Holmes goes off at Tibet as a Norwegian explorer and spends some time in Montpellier and looks in at Mecca. Well, that's more than any writer needs to get several novels out of. So,
sure.
Yes, I made use of him. I took him in the game. I took him back to, not Tibet, but up in the highlands there, up in the Himalayas.
And much more adventurous than what was done in the 7% solution.
Well, that was adventurous of its own way, yes.
Yes, yeah, certainly, definitely.
So getting away from the Holmesian line of questioning for a moment, you've also, as we mentioned, written a series based on a female homicide detective right here in San Francisco. We're based in the Bay Area, mm-hmm. also named Kate Martinelli. If I remember correctly, the series takes place in a similar time period as the Mary Russell series. Is that right?
The Martinellis begin in the late 80s, 1987.
Oh, then totally different time period. For some reason, I thought there was some kind of overlap.
There is. There is one of the Martinelli stories called The Art of Detection. Martinelli comes across a manuscript that is apparently an unknown Sherlock Holmes story.
Ah, okay,
so
that's it.
It's my one attempt at a Holmesian pastiche is found in of detection. So in that sense, yes, they meet, although not in actual fact. My editor had sort of wanted to bring these two series together, and I said, honestly, you want me to bring Mary Russell to San Francisco and what, have this 100-year-old woman arrested for murder? I really don't think so.
That sounds fantastic, but no.
Yeah, that must have been where I got confused, because I haven't read the Kate Martinelli series yet, and I've been looking forward to it. And I knew there was a crossover somewhere. I had read it somewhere. So now I know. I have to say, it was very exciting when reading Locked Rooms to have Holmes walking around Union Square and having this whole experience of living in San Francisco in such a different time from what they were experiencing. It was very cool to kind of go back in time in that way.
Well, in The Art of Detection, Holmes hangs out in rather different parts of town and meets some very interesting individuals in those parts of town, including a very interesting transvestite singer.
So was God of the Hive, is that the last book in the Mary Russell saga, or are we going to see more of her and Holmes in the future?
Oh, it's going to be endless.
Excellent.
Yes, God of the Hive is the one for this year, and I am currently at work on one for 2011 called Pirate King. How is your Gilbert and Sullivan?
Not too good.
Well, you have a year to catch up on Gilbert and Sullivan.
Well, I myself am the very model of a modern major general, but Veronica's not as up on it.
Okay.
So I have a question of my own that I wanted to ask you, and this may not make sense to anyone who hasn't read the books yet. In between The Game and Locked Rooms, Russell and Holmes visit Japan.
Yeah.
What happened there? Did I miss a story in between, or is that just supposed to be filled in?
I really must have put an asterisk there in the footnote. No, what happens is one of those places where the author thinks, oh, man, I really like to go to Japan. So sets the groundwork for a future story in Japan.
Fantastic.
I have not been there yet. I plan to go there, not next spring, but the following year. And there will be a story probably divided between Japan and wherever she is in the current saga, which will probably be the winter of 1924. So it'll probably wrap around half a story that is then continued after they get home.
I actually read God of the Hive in one sitting on a flight to Japan a couple weeks ago.
How yeah. fun.
So that was, I barreled right through it. Okay. So we mentioned Califia's daughters. It seems like a pretty big departure from the mysteries you've written in the past. Why go that direction, that post-apocalyptic kind of futuristic style genre?
Having tackled Holmes, I thought I'd tackle the end of the world.
Next logical step.
Yeah, why not? Califia's Daughters was the book that I started writing first. It was my first attempt at a novel. Mostly what it taught me was that I didn't know how to write a novel, so I put it away, thought about it. And when I had finished it, to my satisfaction, I said to my publisher, look, I really like to see it out there. The way the publishing world works, very difficult to make genres without affecting your numbers. I mean, this is a completely bizarre side effect of the way wholesalers and chains work now. But you have to realize that any book you publish is going to have an effect on your next couple of books down the line. So the way around this was to publish it as a paperback original under a pseudonym. It's written under the name Lee Richards. And that was fine with me. I simply wanted to see it in print. I thought it was a fun book. I thought it was an interesting book. At some point, I would love to write the two parts of the trilogy on either side of it. I always thought of this as being the middle book in a trilogy. And maybe 30 pages of in my files. And the follow-up one, just some vague idea. Someday, if I live long, I'll get to that.
One question that I had before we wrap up here is with dealing with Sherlock Holmes, who is in some parts of the world, I believe, considered public domain, and in other parts of the world still under copyright by the estate. Did you have to get permission? How did you go, or were you able to make fair use of Holmes?
I try to be very fair. I'm not really sure that there is any place where they are definitely under copyright. There are places where they are making the argument to be. But for the most part, they are in the public domain.
That's good. Yeah, that's how do you feel about that? I mean, do you think that the copyright system goes too far in protecting things for too long, or do you think that it should, you know, I mean, you're benefiting from something that's become in the public domain. Where do you fall on that issue?
It's a complicated system, and basically it breaks down into two segments. So you have a longer segment and a shorter one that add up to 75 years. It seems to be a reasonable amount of time.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I know you said you're working on the next book. Do you have any idea when the next book in the Mary Russell saga will go on, or are you still kind of in the planning stages?
I think it's that Pirate King is published in September of 2012. It takes place just after The God of the Hive in 1924. If I can keep track of two different calendars, that's the plan.
Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, that was really fun. Thank you once again to Lori R. King for taking the time to talk to us. And thanks to you for listening to us. Don't forget, you can find out all the links we talk about on the show at our website, swordandlaser.com. You can email us if you've got something to say, theswordandlaser@gmail.com. And don't forget to try out the stickers at Sticker Foo. They've been with us forever. You can get all kinds of cool, geeky stickers. Use the code SWORD1 and get 10% off the stickers at Sticker Foo. That's stickerfu.com. And you can talk to other listeners of Sword and Laser in our Goodreads group. Easiest way to get there is to go to swordandlaser.com and click on the discussions link. Until next time, have fun reading.
Bye.